You're
Michael,
muted.
You're muted.
Thank you. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Tommy. Thank you all for coming. I have a request. Normally, it doesn't really matter to me whether people have their video turned on during this closing or not. But today, I have the luxury of two screens, so I can look at my notes on one screen and see you on the other. So if your bandwidth will support it and you are willing to be seen, thank you. As Jim has hinted, it is my habit to try to talk about the conference that has just ended. This year seems very clearly to be a year marked by Invisible XML. There are paper after paper has talked about it. So it is perhaps not surprising that I have spent a lot of time in the last few months thinking about invisibility and visibility. And a nagging thought kept coming to me about a book I once read, which eventually I was able to, remember enough so that I could find it and reread it. In 1919, an American author named Heywood Broun wrote a children's book. Heywood Broun was mostly a sports writer, but he wrote at least one children's book, The 51st Dragon. And the book is about a large, robust, but not overbright boy named Gawain Le Coeur Hardy, whose teachers are really not quite sure what to do with him, and whose headmaster eventually decides that he will... Maybe Gawain could make a dragon slayer. So they train Gawain in the technique of slaying dragons. And the night before Gawain is to go out and face his first dragon, he has an interview with the headmaster, in which the headmaster, to calm his nerves, says, "I will give you something that will protect you." And Gawain says, "I'd like a magic cap." And the headmaster says, "What? A magic? What's that?" And he says, "A cap to make me invisible." And the headmaster says, "A cap to make you invisible? What would you do with it? Boy, you could walk from here to London and no one would so much as look at you. You couldn't be more invisible than that." That's an important kind of invisibility. It's the invisibility of insignificance. You're invisible because you don't make any difference. And I sometimes suspect that I may not be the only one who, at dark moments in my life, occasionally worries that in the diagram of the Gartner hype cycle that Michael Kay talked about on Sunday in the pre-conference talk, in which you start with a rising curve of hype and excitement about a new technology, in which people develop and encourage inflated expectations. And then you have a trough that follows when people realize that the inflated expectations will not be met and things have been overpromised. And so there's disappointment. And Michael described a curve in which eventually the technology is applied in places where it's appropriate and it's useful and used, and it gradually recovers. So the value of its notional Y value eventually rises again. But you know, not every technology does that. Some just crash and disappear. And in dark moments when I near despair, I sometimes worry, are we invisible because we're in that trough and we'll never get out of it? Well, obviously, it's not a dead technology. It's a living and useful technology. All you have to do is look at the talks, think about the talks you've heard here. But, you know, we can temper that with the observation that there are lots of technologies that are effectively dead that are still in use. There are working ALGOL 68 compilers. And there are, therefore, people who currently are writing ALGOL 68 programs. But I don't think anyone expects ALGOL 68 to have a long future life or to make more difference to the world of IT than it already has. And in those moments of worry, I sometimes also worry, is the subtitle to Alex Malowski's talk suggestive? Will someone steal our lunch? Will people be able to use GQL to do all of the things that we can do with XSLT and XQuery and more? Will GQL kill XQuery and XSLT? Well, having experience of all the things I can do with XQuery and XSLT, I kind of doubt it. But I also note that if we are able to do with GQL everything we can do with XQuery and XSLT and more, then those of us who years ago got the religion of application-independent data representations will be in a much better place to exploit those capabilities of GQL than people who locked their data into specific applications which no longer run, or into data with no established serialization format. It's not enough to have a good coherent data model. The relational model is great and very clearly, very explicitly described. But when the database people showed up in the XML working groups in the late 1990s, it wasn't because XML was being widely hyped, although it was at the time. They showed up because it met a need that they had. There is no standard form for exchanging data exported from SQL databases. And I said, wait a second, what about comma-separated values? Don't they work? And they said, they don't have a character encoding declaration. We need XML because problems loading CSV files are the single greatest cost to our customer support. And the usual cause of problems is character set issues. So maybe that's not going to be an issue. But then as long as I'm worrying, maybe markup will become unnecessary. Will markup become unnecessary because it can be automated and AI can take care of it all? Paul Prescott and Phil Tornrod showed us a system that transcribes a medical interview and then generates a report based on it, and no human hands touch it until the physician reviews and edits the report. That's remarkably close to what an enthusiast of AI, a researcher in AI, once told me was the reason that markup was irrelevant. AI can handle it all. Not today. Certainly not when we had that conversation, which was 10, 15 years ago, but soon. And there'll be no need for markup. Well, I think he was wrong for reasons I'll get to in a moment. But maybe he's right. Steve DeRose showed us a way to use AI to produce markup. Uche Obuchi showed us ways to make LLMs useful and try to limit their hallucination by giving toolboxes to the parrots. But I don't think AIs are likely to make markup irrelevant for a couple of reasons. Maybe what will happen with AIs is what has happened with automatic translation. Automatic translation, as you will have noticed if you've ever used it for a text that you understand and care about, is not really ready for prime time. And there is no organization that I'm aware of that actually relies on having documents, especially normative legal documents, available in multiple languages that would dare rely on automatic translation for the final form of those documents. They all use it for the first draft because it's a lot faster to have an automatic translation program produce the first draft and then have a translator edit it than it is to have the translator type the thing in from scratch and then edit it. So maybe AIs will produce the first draft of markup and humans will tweak it and improve it. And then markup will serve as a communication medium between the automatic pass and the human pass. And it will serve as a record for the hand improved result. Or maybe AIs will continue to improve and they'll be able to do markup perfectly. And in that case, markup will still serve as a communications medium between software and human beings, or between software, between organizations, or between us and the future. And markup will be an optimization because, yes, markup inflates the size of many texts, and I.O. is slow and expensive, but I.O. is not nearly as expensive as buying a new power station to allow an AI to re-recognize markup that it already recognized last week. Doing markup by AI is going to be computationally expensive because doing anything with an AI is computationally expensive, and it will make sense to cache the results. Also, we have reason to believe that markup will make LLMs perform better. Patrick DeRusso gave that as a conjecture yesterday during the open mic session. And the other day, Jean-Pauli and Greg Renard made it as an observation. You load data, stripping out the markup, and ask a question. You load the same data with the markup, ask the same question, get a dramatically better answer. So even in my dark moments, I don't really fear that AI is going to eat my lunch. Although I am extremely glad that there are people like Paul Prescott and his colleagues and Steve DeRose and Uche who are trying to make sure that we have ways of keeping the AIs honest, as it were, and checking their work and making sure that we are not required to take it on faith. If XML sometimes seems invisible to the larger IT community, maybe there's another reason. Maybe it's because sometimes we behave like a rather standoffish group. As Joe Goldner put it at yesterday's open mic, Silicon Valley bros said in a meeting, well, we hate XML. And he said, it's okay for you to hate XML because XML hates you too. And sometimes we act that way. We act as though we really don't want to have anything to do with non-XML data. And we will become more visible in the general IT community if we engage more effectively with non-XML data. And that is part of the core story of Invisible XML, as demonstrated by several talks, Joseph Courtney and Michael Grick, talking about how to use iXML to parse magnetic resonance data scripts. Ari Nordstrom talking about how to use iXML to parse and edit and then reserialize S2000M messages in the aerospace industry. Joe Goldner, in his talk the other day, showing examples of how XML can play a role, even in a larger production where there are many roles to be played and there are many other actors and not just XML. We have to get good at this, because otherwise that quip about XML hating you too will be a little too true to be comfortable. So I'm very glad that we have people like Norm Walsh and Debbie Lockett, who showed us the other day in their sponsor presentation on Saxon.js, not only major new functionality, but dramatic improvements to the foreign function interface. Now, if you're like me, you have seen the term foreign function interface before, and your eyes have always glazed over just a little bit, because it has never seemed particularly relevant. And it's not particularly relevant to me, because I don't tend to write multilingual applications. I tend to like being able to write an application in a single language, either XSLT or XQuery. But I am not typical of the IT industry as a whole in that way. And if we want to be visible and play a role in the IT industry in general, we need to play better with others. And foreign function interfaces are the way that that happens. They are the ground rules of the kindergarten playground. We're not a church, even though we may get religion and we may experience some kinds of euphoria that are resemble those of religious conversion. So we need to deal calmly and constructively with the fact that not everyone uses XML. And to do that, it's important not just to be able to move non-XML data into XML so that we can use the XML stack. It is also important to be able to move it back. Now, several of the papers we saw this week have used manually constructed reserializations, and that's always possible. XSLT is great for that. So is XQuery. But it would be really nice to be able to automate it or automatically detect the cases where it can be automated and where it can't. And for that, the work that John Lumley was talking about is important. The work that Stephen Pemberton reported at I cannot remember now whether it was Prague or Amsterdam on round tripping is important. But there's another kind of invisibility that has a slightly more positive valence, and I want to talk about that. Really great athletes, it is often said, are characterized by the fact that they make things look easy. Really great dancers are characterized by the fact that they make it look natural what they do. Typography, at least in some schools of thought, is held to be best when it is least visible, or at least non-irritating, as Tony Rand put it the other day. And a lot of people say about any infrastructure that they like, it just works. I don't have to think about it. It just works. Tony Graham talked about it. Mary Holstead showed an example of making an infrastructure that will just work by experimenting with the opportunities offered by both your backend library and by language construction and by iXML as a tool for mediating between the two. Perhaps the best example that I know of this kind of invisibility, and one of a certain amount of symbolic importance, I guess, for the markup community, are the tunnels under Disney World. Not everyone is aware of this, but beneath Disney World in Florida, there is a network of tunnels, standardized size, large enough for electric vehicles to pass each other in lanes. well-signed, and invisible to most visitors to the park. It's of symbolic importance to the markup community, in part because those of you who have been here long enough will have heard old-timers talk about the time that Yuri Rubinsky talked about the tunnels under Disneyland. So it's part of our lore. It is said that Walt Disney got the idea for tunnels when he was inspecting Disneyland in Anaheim. And he was offended to see a man in a buckskin jacket with fringes and a coonskin hat and so on, walking through the streets of Tomorrowland, where he had no business. And I'm not sure whether I've made this part of the story up, but the way I think of it is, he talks to the guy and says, "What are you doing here?" And he says, "My shift starts in Frontierland in 5 minutes. This is the only way to get there." And so Walt Disney conceived the idea that he wanted the guy from Frontierland to be able to get to his shift without being seen. So he needed an invisible tunnel. Well, too late for Disneyland, but they were about to build Disney World. So he explains to the engineers and the architects, "I want a network of tunnels underneath the park." And they said, "Sorry, boss, not going to happen. The water table here is about 2 feet deep. And there's really no way to keep tunnels dry. We can't have tunnels." Well, they do have tunnels. The way they have tunnels is they built the tunnels at ground level, and then they filled in dirt over them, the spoils from the lakes they were digging and other water features. So the park, I have read, is 12 or 14 feet above the natural ground level at that area. So the tunnels remain dry. And they're standardized. They provide services. There's always a garbage chute. Because one of the things that's invisible in Disneyland at the surface level is garbage collection. There are no garbage trucks. There are no overfull garbage bins waiting to be emptied. Because there are no conventional garbage bins at all. There are little slots through which you can toss garbage, and it goes into a pneumatic tube and is carried to a collection point some miles away. There is standardized signage in these tunnels so that people who aren't terribly familiar with them can get to where they're going. They can reach to Frontierland just by following the right colors. And there's medical attention and staff and all of the other kinds of infrastructure that you need when you have that many people in that small space over an extended period and don't want them to be distracted from the things you want to call to their attention. So invisibility can be good. It can be a sign of perfection. I think of it as a kind of instantiation of the maxim you sometimes hear, that there is no limit to what you can achieve if you don't mind other people getting the credit. And if you want the kind of infrastructure about which people say it just works, then you need to make it reliable. So you need people like Amanda Galtman working to maintain testing infrastructures like XSPEC, working to explain to those of us who are not quite as ingenious how to use constructs that we wouldn't have thought of using to make tests that we would otherwise not have been able to make. We need people like Mark Gross building industrial scale systems to deal with hundreds of millions of legal citations and to ensure the quality of large collections of XML data. And performance is crucial. So we need people like Alan Paxton and Adam Redder building test beds to allow customers to evaluate XML databases and allow developers of XML databases to test and improve their own performance. On Monday, Tommy Usden talked about the virtues of unbundling things, breaking up bundles and selling the components. And of course, if you take something that's been bundled and you break it up into its pieces, then one of the immediate consequences is that in principle, at least, it becomes possible to pick and choose. So I can pick these components from this, from what used to be this bundle, and that component from that bundle. That works, of course, only if they will interoperate, only if the corresponding pieces are interchangeable. So there's a certain irony here, I think. You have to expose the boundaries. You have to make the boundaries between the parts of what was the bundle visible and standardize them so that they can be used as the interface between what are now independent components. That turns out to be more powerful and more useful than it may seem at first glance. I don't know whether anybody predicted that a specification whose grammatical requirements can be summarized as you delimit every tag with delimiters so that it's easy to tell the difference between tags and content, and you delimit every element with tags so that you can see where the element begins and the element ends. And that's basically all of the syntactic rules. I don't know if anybody predicted that that would be a large enough, a wide enough space to stand to support any infrastructure at all. I would have thought that's almost vacuous, right? But on the basis of that really thin kind of standardization, it turns out to be possible to build information retrieval systems, document display systems, editors, all sorts of things, without people having to agree on what the tags mean or anything like that, so that we have a really surprise, what to me was at least a very surprising combination of the ability to build a common infrastructure while still allowing different people to be interested in and working with different, very different models of the world and models of their data. There's also a certain irony in Tommy's urging us to unbundle things because it turns out that people don't always want that. At least in some cultures and for some variants of human psychology, people want a simple, careless experience. I want to pay the money and then not worry anymore. I would really like to buy a ticket and have a seat and be able to check a bag and be greeted at the gate by someone friendly and so forth. And the ability of the airlines to break those all out and charge separately for each one. Well, even if the total cost is not higher, I find that I tend to resent feeling as if I'm being nickeled and dimed to death. And other people apparently feel the same way. I was once at a web services conference, and I asked the attendees, how many of you use a server from one vendor and client software developed from another vendor? And there may or may not have been one or two hands. But almost everybody in the room used a server software and client software developed with the same toolkit, which meant not that they were in danger of being locked in, but that they had already been locked in by their vendors. The standardization of web services was almost completely irrelevant to them. If you pump gas at a convenience store in North America, I am told that The chances that XML is going through the cables underneath your feet is are directly proportional to the likelihood that the cash register and gas pump were sold to the store by different vendors. If they're the same vendor, then what's passing through the cables underneath your feet are proprietary messages, and they may or may not be XML. If they're from different vendors, what's going through is XML, standardized by the Petroleum Convenience Store Technology Alliance. And when people talk about schemas as contracts, in that environment, they are not speaking metaphorically, because when the cash register throws an error on a message it receives from the gas pump, validity against the validity of that message against the schema is what determines whose field engineer gets to go out and figure out what the problem is and fix it. Now, one consequence of our saying of infrastructure that just that we like, that it just works and it's invisible, is that we tend to think of infrastructure as invisible, or rather, we tend not to think about infrastructure at all. Karl Marx had a term for this. He called it Verdinglichung, which is usually rendered in English as reification, which I find confusing for reasons I'll get back to. It means regarding a state of affairs as just the way things are. It's just a thing. It has a nature. We cannot change the nature of that any more than we can change the nature of this rock or that tree. It is what it is. Marx notes that this point of view is often encouraged by the powerful as a way of thinking by the powerless, as a way of preventing the powerless from thinking about social relations as something that could be different, something that could be changed. So it's a way of protecting a power advantage. Now, the power relations between programmers and users, especially data users or data owners, are perhaps not as dramatic and maybe not as clear as the relations of economic power that Marx was interested in. But I find it very difficult to hear programmers say, oh, we don't really like XML, without seeing a power dynamic at work. Because, of course, programmers gain power from non-reusability of data. If my program is the only way that you can interact with the data, then you're dependent on my program. I'm one up. And if the data representation is standardized so that other programs could also be used on it, then I'm one down as a programmer. I have less control. Also, if I don't expose my data representations, then I have sole control of them and nobody can second guess me, which is appealing for psychological as well as power reasons. Programmers gain from non-reusability and non-standard data representations. Users gain from exposed and standardized data representations. And that is one reason, I think, that declarative markup and descriptive markup so frequently feel to users like tools of liberation. Like tools of enlightenment. Now, the invisibility of things is not always so obvious. Hidden bias is hard to see precisely because it's hidden. What that means is if we enter a world in which we rely on programs, but there is no way to easily trace a direct line between a program structure and its data on the one hand and its behavior on the other, then any bias in the construction of the program or in this construction of the program's data store is going to be very difficult to detect. I do not have enough linear algebra to understand the bias involved in the data representations of any large language model. And as far as I can tell, neither does anybody else, including the people who build the large language models. So this effect is very real. Things we don't want to look at sometimes become effectively invisible. We may sometimes be able to detect them indirectly. Take an example. Orchestra musicians, symphony musicians in North America are typically well-educated, open to the world, friendly, not the kind of people we typically associate with ethnic or gender bias. And so there was no particular reason to suspect that North American symphony orchestras suffered from or exercised bias in hiring musicians. After all, we hire musicians for the sound they make, not for the way they look or anything else. But some years ago, orchestras changed the way they ran auditions by putting a screen in the room with the player auditioning for a position with the orchestra on one side of the screen, and the player's committee charged with choosing whom to hire on the other side of the screen. So they could hear the auditioner playing, but they couldn't see the audition, they couldn't see the job applicant. And although there was no reason to believe that orchestras suffered from hiring bias, when that happened, suddenly you started seeing female French horn players. Suddenly you started seeing Black percussionists. Now, I am sure that there is still a way to go before orchestras reach perfect equity, because different cultural backgrounds lead to tensions that cause problems and so forth. But introducing that screen allowed orchestras to detect that they had been suffering from bias and allowed them a way, partially at least, to correct that bias. What I wonder is, where can we find the screens we need to help us fight biases that we don't yet know we have, or even the biases that we suspect we might have just because we see them elsewhere in the world? It's not hard to look at the screen in front of you and see that by IT standards, we have medium good representation of women in our markup community. And of course, the star power of people like Tommy Usden and Debbie LePere and Mary Holstead, Beth and Toby Walsh, and so on, may make us think, well, women are fully equal in this community. But purely statistically, count the faces and names in front of you, and you will see that we are some ways away from 50-50 gender equity. And for other kinds of diversity, ethnic, cultural, neurodivergent, it is not hard to see, it is hard not to see that we are very, very far from achieving the kind of diversity and balance that we ought to have. We would like our communities, our conferences, our working groups to be welcoming to everybody. And I've never seen anybody engage in any overt acts that I interpreted as being intended in a hostile way. But we can see from who's there and who's not there that not everybody feels welcome. I have no idea what to do about this. There is one thing I think we should work at not doing, though, and that is pretending that we don't have a problem. We have to think about it. We have to work on it. And there are other people who aren't here today, who are invisible on our screens, people who've been part of the community for of those working on descriptive markup and working to make the web a better place for years, whom we have lost. We've lost a number of people this year. I won't attempt to list them, but I think it's important that we remember them. Fortunately, although their faces may be invisible in the Zoom window, we can see their traces in the technology all around us. I don't know about Marx, but Marxists tend, in my experience, to attribute every kind of reification in the Marxian sense, every kind of Verdinglichung, as a willful attempt by someone to hide things from other people. I'm not sure that's always true. Sometimes I think it's just hard to see things. And exposing them, making them visible, makes them available for us to think about them, whether they were consciously and intentionally hidden before or not. So Liam Quinn's work, making document type definitions accessible in XML, is a perfect example of the kind of enlightenment that we can achieve by making things seeable. Now, one of the reasons they haven't been visible in the past is, I think, just a timing issue. I think there may have been a very small window during which it would have been possible to create an XML representation of document type definitions. Sorry, I got into that a little early. I need to say they haven't been visible because they're not exposed in the SACS and DOM interfaces. And the reason they're not exposed in the SACS and DOM interfaces, it says here, is it's not obvious exactly how you would want them to be exposed. They're not, you know, they're document type declarations are different. And you would have had to have a whole new branch of the DOM and a whole new branch of SACS. Just the way the grammar of XML doubles in size when you start talking about DTDs, as did the grammar of HTML. But if you had an XML representation for document type definitions, as Liam has provided and other people have provided over time, then you have an obvious way to expose that information. It's structured information, and you expose it the way you expose any structured information. You have XML elements and attributes, you expose them. And then you can argue about what the element names should be and what the structure should be, but your APIs become simpler. If we had done that right at the beginning, might have been built into SACS and DOM. But right at the beginning, although there were proposals for XML representations of DTDs, they were, how can I say this politely, politically divisive. And the chair of the XML working group, John Bosak, made the Solomonic decision that he was going to try to avoid having the entire thing explode by not putting that question to the working group. He didn't give that to the working group as a choice. So by default, we continued with the existing syntax. And by the time the XML schema working group was formed a year or so later, it was probably a little too late, because at one of the early meetings of the schema working group, we asked, trying desperately to limit the scope of the working group so they would finish its work in the foreseeable future, One possibility would be just an XML version of DTDs. Another would be that plus object-oriented inheritance and other stuff. And another would be something else, even more ambitious. Who would be happy with just an XML version of DTDs as our first deliverable? We can do the others later. And there may have been two or three people who raised their hands. The only problem is there were 50 or 60 people in the room, so three people was really not going to do it. And it didn't happen. And so they weren't in the... So DTDs were not exposed in the APIs. So they have been invisible. But Liam has shown us a way to make them visible. And similar, the same thing is true of John Lumley's emphasis on the fact that since there is an IXML grammar for IXML grammars, we can work on IXML grammars in XML. We can read an IXML grammar and we can apply XML processing to do things with it, to display it, to modify it, to make it define a related but different language, and so on. We can achieve greater clarity just by making things visible. Now, sometimes greater clarity is just as simple as dividing things in two. Sid Bauman talked to us today about why two XPaths are better than one. And a lot of what he said seems to me to have to do with the fact that having two XPaths allows you to think of one as setting the context and the other as dealing with details, or, you know, it's the setup and then the serve, or however you want to describe it. Dividing it into two pieces gives you a point of purchase at which you can help control the complexity of what you're trying to do. And controlling complexity and understanding better what we're doing is extremely useful. I tend to conflate liberation with enlightenment, partly, I guess, because Kant defined enlightenment as the exit of the human being out of a self-imposed minority or tutelage dependency, becoming becoming responsible for oneself entails being aware, self-aware, and that requires knowledge. So anything that helps us improve our understanding seems important to me, like the work reported by Alan Wynier the other day on deviant causal chains. If you're like me, you may have found that large parts of that talk went right over your head. It seemed very rarefied. Logic chopping is the affectionate term that philosophers use for that style of analysis. And logic chopping is really important if you want to understand a concept. You know, it's simpler and more comfortable if we just say X knows Y, and we all know what knows means. It becomes, however, a richer concept if we say, no, knowledge can be divided into parts. There are sub-properties that we can attribute in cases of knowledge. And of course, when you do that, you may find, as Alan illustrated, that your analysis isn't quite right. And that can feel tedious if that's not on the... Clarifying that can feel tedious if clarifying it is not on the short path between you and your immediate goals. But I think it's important because clarity is the basis of our progress. Of course, sometimes the easiest way to make something visible is to visualize it. And sometimes things are in principle already visible, but the patterns in them are hard to perceive. You will have noticed that this tie has characters on it. If you're really perceptive, you will have noticed that this is an encoding of an XML declaration. And if you are really, really attentive, you'll know that there's a typo. But not everybody sees that at first glance. And sometimes a good way to make patterns visible is to transpose the information in which they're embedded into a different form, as illustrated by Bethan Tovey-Walsh today in her talk about crocheting as a way of representing patterns in a series of arbitrary input data. And the same is true of the pair of talks with which we began the conference after Tommy's introduction on Monday morning. In literary studies, and indeed in all text-based historical studies, there is a huge invisibility. Textual variation, one of the most basic facts of texts, is virtually invisible in literary criticism or philosophy or historical work with documents. Mainline scholars really don't like to think about it because they feel the ground shifting under their feet. And so they don't think about it and they don't talk about it. Textual editors work to make the variation visible by putting textual apparatus into their editions. But of course, other editors immediately come along and make other editions in which the variation is hidden by omitting the apparatus or by banishing it to the back of the book where no one will consult it. And textual editing itself is invisible in the sense of being underappreciated. Editors don't get credit. They don't get tenure. There are all sorts of problems for textual editors. And that is why I think the work that Ronald Hentjens-Dekker and David Birnbaum reported on Monday is of tremendous import for all of us who care about the preservation of our cultural heritage. How can we make textual variation and the patterns it makes easier to see, easier to name, easier to think about, easier to work with? They have a dragon well worth slaying. And they didn't need an invisibility cap. What they needed and what they had was a way to make things visible. Thank you all for Balisage 2024. Come back next year.